Coming up, got Nick Gallo talking OKC Thunder, CP the franchise on the New York Knicks, and I got some things that are keeping me up at night about the finals, the draft, and NBA rumors. We get into all of that next. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got our finals matchup, Pacers, Thunder. I can't wait till game one on Thursday, and it's June now. It's June, which means the draft is just in a few weeks. We got trade rumors getting way louder in recent days. And I've got seven questions keeping me up at night. So let's get into all of it, starting with the NBA Finals. Question number one on my mind. Can Andrew Nembhard do to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander what he did to Jalen Brunson in game six? Because Nembhard was amazing in game six. In game six, he defended Brunson more plays than he did in the first five games of the series. 55 plays defending Brunson, who shot only 2 of 10 in those matchups. 49 plays in games 1 through 5 combined. Brunson was 9 for 15 in those matchups. Now, you know, you think about what Nembhard did against Brunson. It was supposed to be a Nesmith series. That's who's been Indiana's best defender against Brunson last year in their matchup together and then during the regular season. But Nembhard stepping up in that game six, flying around screens, sticking to Brunson, picking him up early. It makes me wonder, looking ahead to the finals now, is it going to be Nembhard versus SGA? Is this the key to Indiana winning this series? Because during the season, we saw Nembhard as the primary defender against Gilgeous-Alexander. Not so good success. SGA had a game over 40 points. He had a game over 30 points. They didn't have Chet in those games. SGA was dominant without OKC at full strength. Obviously, the playoffs are different. You're able to be far more physical, not going to get to the line quite as often. But the size difference, SGA was able to plow through Nembhard. He was able to shoot over the top of him. I wonder still, like, am I underestimating Nembhard here when I think about how he matches up against SGA? Because it did not work great during the regular season. Indiana, they don't like to double a lot either. Are they going to be forced to have to double? In the playoffs, they doubled Mitchell 14.8% of his touches. They doubled Garland 14.6% of his touches. They doubled Brunson only 13.9% of his touches. So they were playing single coverage against Brunson a lot, not throwing doubles, whereas SGA has faced doubles on 22% of his touches this entire postseason. Is Indiana going to be forced to be a little bit different than they want to be against SGA because of the size difference, because of the matchup problem that SGA presents? And that brings me to question number two on my mind. Will Rick Carlisle pull out the zone defense? Carlisle, I mean, of course, in the past, we saw him do this with Dallas. Way back in the day, he used the zone defense against the Heat in the NBA Finals in 2011. It's one of the reasons why Dirk and Terry and all those guys, J.J. Barea, won the NBA Finals against the Heat. Indiana does not use zone too much at all, but OKC forces you to be something way different than you want to be. If you look at the stats, regular season versus playoffs, Minnesota during the regular season had 2.1% of their half-court possessions using zone defense, went up to 9% against Oklahoma City. Denver, 2.9% of their zone of possessions in the half-court were zoned during the regular season, up to 36% against Oklahoma City in their matchup. Indiana, only 3.3% of their possessions in the half-court have been zoned. And in the playoffs, they've only had three plays where they've used zone. Only three total. Is that going to change against Oklahoma City? Because OKC forces you to be different. Their defense is so awesome, obviously, but their offense also is incredibly challenging to defend with the spacing they have, the lineup versatility they have. And like Indiana knows, having five guys on the floor that can make plays off the dribble is the secret sauce, man. That's what Boston did last year in the postseason. It's what both Indiana and OKC have now. So is Carlisle going to have to pull out the old zone defense what he did with the Mavs against the Heat. And obviously that Mavs team was a heavy zone team. They used it all year long and they just ramped it up against the Heat. But I wonder, is that something we're going to see? Are we going to see a zone from a team that doesn't like to use zone against the Indiana Pacers? That's what I'm very interested about, because with Indiana, to me, it all starts there. We know their offense is going to be doing what they do. OKC's defense is going to be doing what they do. It's a clash of a great offense and a great defense. But OKC's offense is also an issue too. So I've been thinking a lot about how does Indiana's defense respond to that. We're going to talk a lot more about the NBA Finals later. I got Nick Gallo, OKC sideline reporter, in this podcast. And then on Wednesday morning, you'll hear my podcast with Mo DeHeel going even deeper into some of the X's and O's and a lot more about the series. But up next, I want to talk about the Knicks, because it's funny. I sometimes you post something on social media and you think it's just a fairly dry, boring comment. I posted, trading Cat should be the number one priority for the Knicks. And people lost their minds. 1.3K replies, 1.7K quotes, 14K likes, 700 bookmarks. And I got one very, very annoyed person in Cat's orbit sending me a very, you know, annoyed text as well. But you know what? I stand by it. Should the Knicks explore Karl Anthony Towns? And to discuss that, from Knicks Fan TV, here's CP the Franchise. All right, CP, season did not end the way you would have hoped for with the New York Knicks. And as soon as the season ended, story dropped at The Athletic. James Edwards and Fred Katz with some stuff in there about how the Knicks don't love Kat. Jalen Brunson, Mikal Bridges, some of the Nova guys don't really love Kat's approach on defense. What was your initial reaction to this? Is it surprising at all? Because for me, I feel like this stuff's been floating out there for a little while now.
Not surprising in the least. I mean, you can watch it and see in terms of in certain games, you know, their discussion and some of the frustration you saw on the bench, OG Anunoby and Karl Anthony Towns getting into it during the playoffs where Jalen Brunson had to intervene. Well, how about the game against Golden State where, you know, several times Karl Anthony Towns is in a drop trying to defend Stephen Curry. And you can see the bench, people called into the show saying that, listen, the bench is imploring him, get up on the level, move up on the level, and he's dropping back against Stephen Curry, a guy that he's had numerous years of experience playing against. And so the Karl Anthony Towns experience on the defensive side left a lot to be desired for the Knicks. I'm sure there was cause for a lot of frustration. So, you know, the story's not really surprising to me, but what is surprising is that for the entire year, this team just could not get on the same page defensively, and they suffered because of it.
Now, I think, you know, Kat obviously is not the only guy to blame here. The Hart had a tough series. He blamed himself post-game after game six. At times, he's an offensive liability. Bridges, they gave up six firsts for him, and he's obviously still critical to their defense, but he's nowhere close to the shooter that they thought they were getting. Brunson still dribbles the air out of the ball. It works, but defensively, total liability, that's an issue here, and I think it's the key issue. This is why I posted after the game, trading Cat should be the number one priority for the Knicks because of the fit with Brunson. Brunson, Cat's a flawed duo, CP. They're never going to win a title together because of the way they are just a mismatch on defense. Brunson got attacked relentlessly. There's no hiding him on even Nesmith because Indiana, too much guard and wing screening. They're bringing everybody into ball screens with Halliburton. There's no hiding Brunson. And so anytime he's off the floor, you saw how they're better. Switching one through four, Deuce McBride and other guys on that team better at screen navigation, better at switching and holding up. But the issue is that even with that, like, you still need your offensive engine in Brunson. Towns couldn't contain Siakam when he had to play the four when he defended him. Siakam shred him apart, too fast for him. Cat's always been aloof. You mentioned his drop defense at times. Jason Timpf over at Hoops Tonight had great analysis over on his channel talking about some of the poor decisions by Cat in transition. He said he rewatched every Indiana transition two-point basket, and nearly all of them were caused by, he wrote, poor floor balance. And the primary culprit, he wrote, Karl Anthony Towns, who would repeatedly crash or cut from the top of the key when he was specifically responsible for getting back. And so Cat's not entirely to blame, but the reason why I think that the Knicks should think about trading him here, CP, is because they're not going to move Brunson. They right. have to make some changes. And Karl Anthony Towns, in theory, could be the guy that nets you the greatest return. Am I crazy here for even thinking about something like this? Should the Knicks be all in going on run it back? Or am I onto something here with thinking about trading Cat?
Yeah, well, Knicks Nation really crashed out on you after that, man. I saw that. I said, oh, man, KOC's catching tomatoes here, man.
I was like, I was shocked. I thought it was just gonna be a boring little post, just a little thought on my mind, and then boom, it's like, I'm gonna kill you.
That was blood in the water for a fan base that had just lost. The team had just lost in six. But no, look, you bring up an interesting point. I think it is valid, but it has to be for the right person. Now, if Giannis and World Wide West and Leon Rose can pull off the greatest coup in the NBA history, where you can trade a Karl Anthony Towns for Giannis without giving up much of your depth, then you have to look at it, because I've said it all year that the Knicks cannot win a ring with playing Karl Anthony Towns defensively at the five. It just does not work. And then on top of that, when you have Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns in your starting five defensively, I think that's too much liability or too much weaknesses there in your defense to cover up for, especially when you go up against a team like in Indiana. And so that forced Tom Thibodeau to make the lineup change in game three, go with Mitchell Robinson. The two big lineups had a varying success, but against a team like the Indiana Pacers, who uses their speed and athleticism, I thought Carlisle was able to counter, making it kind of almost neutralizing those two guys at certain points. But we also saw where when you staggered the Brunson and Towns lineups, both guys had much more success with each other on the bench, both offensively and defensively. So that's going to be a big question for Leon Rose going forward, is how do you maximize this five, especially on the defensive end, to really play at a championship caliber where you're not getting exposed? And then also offensively, are we maximizing Karl Anthony Towns and the talent that we have here? That's going to be the million-dollar question here. Is Tibbs going to be the guy to do it? Can they bring in an offensive coordinator? But just running it back with this same five, I don't see much success there for the Knicks.
I mean, first of all, I'd be floored, CP, if the Knicks got Giannis. I just don't see how they could come up with the best
offer. I don't see it.
Very honest. No. The guy that's on my mind, Kevin Durant. Flip Cat to the Suns for Kevin Durant. Phoenix, Devin Booker and Cat have known each other since they were in college together in Kentucky. They have a great friendship still to this day. Phoenix could have appeal in Cat with Booker. And for the Knicks, Kevin Durant, way older, but better than Karl Anthony Towns. And then you flip Josh Hart and get a big. Mitch, another big. You have your multiple guys play with a big man rotation, but KD is an upgrade over Cat. I know he's older. You cringed when I said it. So you're you wouldn't be before that.
The politics with KD. It's tough. It's tough, man. He's older. He's more injury prone now, right? He's a guy who is going to come up with a hamstring or a calf injury or some sort of lower extremity injury through the course of the year. The Knicks with Karl Anthony Towns, he had a relatively healthy year despite the right knee tendinopathy. He had the bruised left knee in the Pacers series. He had a couple of a bone chip in his thumb and almost a broken finger in his non-shooting hand. He was able to get through relatively okay and still contributed on the offensive end. With the KD experiment, you're really shortening this window here. And yes, he is a more reliable shot creator, but I just see bad vibes with the Kevin Durant move for Karl Anthony Towns. While I agree, well, agree with
thing,
you.
Here's because, the thing though, CP. Yeah. One thing you said, you mentioned shortening the window. You got to go for it. Like, the window is open right now, man. Celtics, Tatum out for possibly all of next season, or at least, you know, not quite the same all of next season if he does return. Bucks possibly trading Giannis. The window's open, dude. Like, you guys did go to a game six with the Pacers. You were there, despite some of the flaws we're talking about that likely would have, you know, led to a finals loss for sure against Oklahoma City. But, like, the window's open. Maybe shortening the window is the point here. Cat's going to be 30. It's not like he's young. Big men, who knows how a big man's going to age when they turn 30. Maybe he lasts until he's 38 years old and has a long, fruitful career. But 30 years old as a seven-footer, you don't know. I think maybe shortening the window's the move here. Got to go for a title. Like, what else are you playing for? You know, just trying to hang. Oh, he went further than we have in decades. Banners like that. That doesn't matter.
No, listen, I think you're right. And it's to me, it's even head scratching that Phoenix is considering keeping Devin Booker when I think they should be all out resetting and tanking. Send him to Houston, try to get your picks back. But the fact that they are considering extending him, making him the highest paid player in the league and keeping him, are they looking towards, you know, being more competitive where a KD for Towns swap would be enticing to them? It will be interesting to see whether Leon Rose, World Wide West, who have that relationship with Karl Anthony Towns, Carl Sr., the CAA connection, would they throw that away for bringing in a mercenary like a Kevin Durant? I think that would be interesting. Look, there's no question that KD can help. I just see bad vibes with that type of move, man. He had his opportunity to come here. He passed on it. And I don't know.
It was too early before. It was too early for him to go to New York before. It just was. Yeah. Like the Nets, it was the wrong choice. But the Nets were better set up to, in theory, win right away. I understand the decision, but ultimately, yes, he did. He should have chosen the Knicks. I just think it was too early. To me, it feels like now is the right time. Now is the right moment where you can be the piece that puts you over the top, and he can't be the only move. It can't just be Cat for Kevin Durant. You still need another big man, obviously. You can't just have Mitchell Robinson all year long. You still need to limit his minutes. But if you can flip Hart, you know, for a big or somebody else for a big, and Cat for KD, and maybe because of the age difference, maybe the Suns would give something back in addition to Kevin Durant in that scenario. I don't think you can rule that out. Only 1 year left on KD's deal. Not a lot of suitors as of now. We'll see if that changes. I think the Knicks, they're close, but Brunson, Cat, one of the reasons why I lean towards Cat, and I know you're right, like you bring up the CAA aspect, and that's a big part of it, CP. Like the CAA, basically, you know, Leon Rose was part of CAA at one point. They still have a relationship. They have a lot of CAA players, but they're not going to trade Brunson. Brunson, his dad is the coach on the team. He's part of the fabric of that offense. I just don't think they're going to trade Brunson. To me, Cat, it could be mutually beneficial. Send him to Phoenix. Play with Book. They love each other. Like, maybe it could be mutually beneficial in that scenario, which is one reason why I like that angle. And there's not a lot of other situations I would say make a lot of sense. So even though I say I'd explore trading Cat, that's the only one that really comes right to mind is like, ooh, I would do this. Other than that, it's a lot of, I don't know if this is worth it types of scenarios. But ultimately, like you said yourself, this team's not going to win the finals with Cat and Brunson. So you have to do something.
Yeah.
You have to do something, especially with the East as open as it is right now.
Yes, certainly not with him at the five. And as you mentioned, a lot of the trades or potential trades are tricky because this is a team that's already lacking depth. And so if you're coming up against a scenario where you have to aggregate contracts just to get a little bit better, then how much better can you potentially get without the draft picks, without the draft capital, and an already questionable bench? I know people want to say, yes, the bench was there for Indiana. Tibbs just had to play them. But let's be honest. They needed another shot creator. They needed another ball handler off of that bench. They got outscored by Indiana's bench by almost 100 points. And so there is need for a talent upgrade. Will the Knicks' young players emerge in year two? In particular, Pacome Dottier, who they spent their last first-round pick on, he has to bring it together starting year two, or else this could be headed to Bust City. He's got to take a next step. Are they going to go to Tyler Kolek at the backup point guard? Ariel Huck-Porty showed some things as a potential backup center, but they've really got to hit on these picks and maybe even get lucky in this year's draft, maybe trading up and finding a, you know, junior or senior who's ready to contribute. The Hart thing is very interesting, man, because I thought he had a really, really disappointing series. He's looking like a guy whose game is not going to age very well. The three-point shot was that and there, and then you saw indecisiveness in his transition game, which is his A game. And so coupled with his inabilities defensively, Josh Hart really hurt the Knicks in this series. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with him going forward. Will they break up the roommates is another question that Leon Rose is going to have to address. It's going to be interesting, man.
give me a one word answer, CP. I said Cat would be the number one guy that I'm trying to trade. Who's your number one guy that you're trying to trade as the Knicks?
From the Knicks?
Yeah.
Again, if you're getting a one for one somehow coup for Giannis, I would trade Cat in that scenario. Okay. But other than that, I just don't see the trade that the Knicks can still, where the Knicks can still keep their depth and get better. I don't trust the KD trade. I really don't. Okay. I don't trust the KD trade.
You're talking around the edges then with like moving a Hart. Would that be
around the edges or around the margins? Okay. That's where I'm looking at. If they can get something for Hart. But yeah, again, like Hart gives you a lot, right? When he's on, he's on. He's a triple-double capable guy. Mm-hmm. But man, this year, next year, they've got to consider moving him back to the bench and either starting Robinson, starting McBride, or hey, if they get another vet minimum contract in there, see who's out there in the market they can bring in.
In that two big lineup, barely did it all year long. And then in the playoffs, they start using it. It feels like he starts lowering minutes in the postseason, changing rotations, changing lineups. It feels like Tibbs was playing catch up in the postseason instead of using the regular season to experiment and try different things and prepare his team for every scenario during the playoffs. Do you think they should fire Tibbs?
I think they could use another voice. And if this team is going to be locked into this core, I'd like to see if there's another voice that can maximize the talent that we have, especially
even
on
an
the
assistant. You're saying not even just the head coach.
Bringing an offensive coordinator as an assistant. Tibbs right now looks like he's got way too much control over everything, and not necessarily deferring or consulting with a capable assistant right there on the bench. They need an offensive coordinator to get the most out of Brunson and Towns. I thought we saw in the Indiana series where the Pacers' pressure defense really exposed the Knicks' lack of ball handling, lack of shot creating, and really kept the offense one-dimensional. They should have been playing through Towns a lot more, and I'd like to see an offensive coordinator that's going to emphasize player movement, ball movement, and kind of getting the ball out of Jalen Brunson's hands to maximize everybody else. I just didn't see it there with Tibbs. On top of that, you know, the rotation questions, the rotation decisions were quite questionable. I'm seeing these late games, in particular in game six. How do you have Mitchell Robinson, who had an outstanding game, who had a monster night? How is he not a factor in the fourth quarter when you're looking to get stops? These are the things where Tom Thibodeau's clinging to Josh Hart to be a savior for him. And Josh Hart even admitted himself that he had a nightmare game. So there should have been changes made there. And Thibodeau's, his rotation decisions, the stagnant offense where the Knicks have to fight for everything in every series, the Detroit series, the Celtics series, the Pacers series, nothing came easy for them offensively where it seemed like it should have, based on the fact that you have two all-stars in your lineup and an OB, Mikal Bridges, Deuce McBride. Just felt like it should have been flowing a little bit better.
Definitely should have been. I would definitely look to change out Tibbs or add an offensive coordinator, like you said, to his staff, because it's not like Tibbs is all bad.
Right.
He's part of the reason for the turnaround. So like you got to be careful saying that, but finding another voice, whether it's new head coach or a lead assistant. And I do think they got to look into the KD scenario involving Cat or look at other situations with Cat because of the flaws. But it's going to be an interesting offseason for the Knicks, CP. You and I will see each other in about a month or so in Vegas at NBA Summer League. I look forward to hanging in person, man, and appreciate you joining the show again today.
Anytime, man. Great job all season. And we'll catch up in Vegas, man. Great time.
Likewise, CP. Have a good day. All right, number four, things keeping me up at night. Will someone pull an East worst to first style turnaround? I'm talking like 07 Celtics to 08 Celtics. They win 24 games and then they win the championship because Brian Windhorst on Hoop Collective reported that the Raptors are looking for a big fish and they won 30 games this past season. They weren't very good. They're a young team. And let's be honest here, like they're talking about Giannis. That's who the Raptors are thinking about here. Like Windy did not explicitly say it was Giannis, but it's Giannis. Masai Ujiri tried like hell to trade out for Giannis way back in the 2013 NBA draft. There's literal documentary footage of him talking to Oklahoma City for the number 12 pick to trade up for Giannis. There's evidence of him. This isn't like a team in the past where it's like, oh, we love that guy, we would have taken him. No, Masai wanted Giannis, and he was doing everything he could to go out and get him. Now, we've seen a turnaround like this before. The 07-08 Celtics, they stunk. They lost 19 games in a row. Paul Pierce got hurt midseason. Tony Allen tore his ACL back in 07. The team was bad. Pierce looked like he was going to demand a trade after the Celtics fell from number two draft odds down to number five. And then poof, Danny Ainge trades for Ray Allen with the number five pick. And a couple of weeks later, he goes and gets Kevin Garnett. And a year later, they win the NBA Finals. It's like one of the greatest turnarounds ever. But what we forget from that year is how bad the East was. 06-07, the Eastern Conference standings that year, only two teams had over 50 wins. The Pistons were near the end of their run. The Cavs had a young LeBron. They make the finals. They get smoked by the Spurs. Other than that, it was a bunch of playoff filler, doormats, like bad teams that are easy wins you can check off on the schedule. The East was wide open for the taking at that time in NBA history. Fast forward to today, kind of the same thing. I mean, I know you have the Pacers in the finals. They're really good. They don't seem like they're going anywhere. The Knicks are still really good. The Cavs are still really good. But Bucks could possibly be trading Giannis. They're an old team anyway, even if they were to keep him. The Celtics, possibly no Tatum all of next year. The Pacers, they're great. The Cavs can be great. The Knicks, we'll see. But they're not juggernauts. They're not unbeatable teams. The East is wide open to at least become a four seed, maybe a five seed, and if not the one seed. So I think you can make the argument for the Raptors, the Wizards, the Hornets, the Sixers, the Nets, like these teams, the five teams that missed the playoffs to go all in. But the argument is obviously stronger for some of them more than the others, because you need five ingredients for a worst to first turnaround. And I think Boston showed this off years ago. You need draft capital. That goes without saying. You've got to have tradable picks, preferably picks from another team, because if you're getting star players, nobody's going to want your picks. You need valued youth. You need young guys that have value, that have shown something to another team to have a belief in them as a return for a proven star player. You need a ready core. The Celtics in 07 still had Paul Pierce. They still had an all-NBA, all-star caliber player, somebody that was a draw to other stars, a belief that he's somebody worth building around. They need a core. You need cap flexibility. You need tradable contracts, or you need cap space. You got to have the ability to actually make a deal. And five, most of all, you need incentive. This is most important, because is your franchise under pressure? Is your star going to demand a trade if you don't get somebody else? Is it a new owner? Is there a reason for you to accelerate? Do you have like everything on your team except for the star player? And so I think if you look at the five teams that have missed the playoffs this past year, the Wizards, they have no incentive. The core is nowhere near ready. To me, I don't think they're a team that should or would actually try to go from worst to first. The Sixers, their circumstances are a little different here, so it doesn't totally apply to them. They traded for George already last year. Obviously, Embiid missed a lot of time. They have the number three pick. The only question now is, would they flip George? Would they trade the number three pick? And I'd say yes, they have incentive. They have the core. Yes, they're a worst to first style team for sure. The Nets, they have two guys under contract. They have nobody on that team. They have a ton of cap space. They can do whatever they want. But where's the incentive? They already screwed up in the past. They already tried to go too fast getting KD and Kyrie. I don't totally see the Nets as a team. To me, I think they're going to build more slow here. The Hornets, they're interesting. They have 10 future firsts. They have 11 future seconds. They have a ton of youth on their team, good youth. They have tradable salaries. LaMelo's a former all-star. I know he's always hurt, but he is an all-star caliber player. He is nearing the prime of his career. They have new owners. They have a new front office. There is incentive. The Hornets quietly, to me, if they wanted to, trade the number four pick for your first star and then trade some young guys and a bunch of future picks for your second star, pair them with LaMelo and Brandon Miller. Like something could happen in Charlotte if they wanted it to happen. They're an interesting team that I think is similar to the Raptors, who everybody, of course, is talking about now. They have their own picks. They have good young players. They have tradable contracts. They have incentive. They're stuck in the middle. Masai has only 1 year left on his deal. They're under intense pressure to win. I already reported last week ahead of the Windy report that the Raptors were leaning towards an older, more proven player who can help early in the draft with the number nine picks. So I do believe the Raptors are a threat to make moves here because they meet those requirements, the ingredients to be a worst to first turnaround team. And plus, we saw them do this with Kawhi. There's a history here. They went for Kawhi, traded DeMar DeRozan, even though he was only 1 year with him. So you talk to people around the NBA, teams are thinking about it. Can somebody be like the 07 to 08 Celtics and go from worst to first? Stars have to become available, though, and that leads me to the next question on my mind. Which stars are going to become available? My top 10 trade targets, Giannis obviously would be number one on this list. KD from Phoenix, obviously number two. Jaylen Brown, a big theoretical here. I'd have number three. Jaylen Brown, you'd have to make an enormous offer to the Boston Celtics. Same thing for Derek White on the next line for kind of these potential trade targets to go for. Kawhi Leonard, why not? You know, like screw it. Maybe you get healthy Kawhi for 1 year as a piece for your team. Bam Adebayo, I don't think the Heat are going to trade him, but why not make a phone call? Maybe you go over the top. This is what I'm saying for some of these teams that you just pick up the phone. You just got to pick up the phone and make an offer. If you go over the top, maybe you give yourself a chance to get these guys. Trey Murphy, same thing. Larry Markkinen, he's now trade eligible. Desmond Bane in Memphis. Austin Reeves with the Lakers, if they didn't want him as that third piece, if they prefer somebody else who doesn't handle as much, somebody to better fit Luka, offer more defense. These are the guys I'd be going for if you're one of those teams that wants to go from worst to first or from the middle to closer to the top. And I think for, you know, Boston, you could see them go either way, though. I wouldn't totally rule out Tatum returning in February or March. And so with Boston, I'm not so certain they'd actually trade Jaylen Brown or Derek White, but it's worth making a call anyway. And you might have to go over the top, though, and maybe a team would. Question number six, are we sure the Spurs should take Dylan Harper? Now, I think they're going to take Dylan Harper if they stay at the number two pick. I think they're going to take Dylan Harper. I just don't see them going any other direction if they keep the number two pick. But let's see the stats on screen here. There's no denying the poor fit issues with them as shooters. De'Aaron Fox in his career, only 35% on spot up threes. Castle, 29.8% as a rookie and in college combined. Dylan Harper, let's combine his college and high school games going back to 2023. Harper, only 33.7% on spot up threes, 28.2% on pull up threes, 32.6% on pull up twos, 72.5% from the free throw line. These are not good shooting numbers. They're not for Harper, for Castle, or for Fox. And you're telling me that's the core you're going to move forward with around Victor Wembanyama? I don't totally see it. I get the idea of it. Multi-creators, that's what Indiana's doing. That's what OKC's doing. It's what Boston did last year. It's where the league is going with five guys on the floor who can shoot, who can handle, who can defend multiple positions, who can play fast. And Harper can do that downhill. He can do that. He can pass. He fits in that regard. But the shooting is a real concern in San Antonio, unless you're forcing Victor to be a glorified spot-up shooter. I want Victor at the rim as much as possible with as much space as possible. And so I'm not saying the Spurs are going to not take Harper at number two. I think they should take Harper if they stay at number two. But I think above doing that, they should trade down or trade out. Go get Giannis. Be a team that goes and get a star player. Go get Giannis and another guy. I think the Spurs should either go that path or trade down, because I really have concerns here about the Fox Castle Harper fit. Harper, I don't know if it matters. It might matter. If you look at his father, Ron Harper, basically posted identical stats to Dylan Harper as a shooter. He was 29% in his career as a three-point shooter, 72% from the line. If touch is inherited, like it is Dell Curry to Steph Curry and a lot of these guys that enter the league, second-generation players, if touch is inherited, I don't feel a lot of confidence and Harper becoming some elite shooter, which he'd have to be next to Fox and Castle. So I can't help but wonder if we're going to see a trade down there. Next up, number seven, are we about to witness the birth of a dynasty? To talk about that, here's Nick Gallo. Now joining me is Nick Gallo. Nick, I got the shirt, baby.
Amazing. I love it. How did you get that, man?
The girl who made the shirt, I saw her post, like a post popped up on my For You page. And I was like, obviously share it all over your socials. And for people who are listening, not viewing, it's a shirt of Nick Gallo, the GOAT. With all the players, OKC guys around him, of all the post game festivities, people putting towels and jerseys and everything and on you. It's beautiful. It's one of my favorite things from this season, Nick.
It's really amazing. And it just, it's unbelievable that these guys have included me in the way that they celebrate one another out there on the floor. I mean, it really speaks to the character of these guys that, you know, they go out of their way to treat somebody the way that they do, like me. And they do this throughout the organization. You know, there's people up and down this organization that serve these guys and get them ready for games. And these Thunder players, they treat them with the exact same level of dignity and respect that they do me. And so I feel so lucky that I've gotten to be a part of this ride. And obviously, it's been so special to see the fans and the way that they've responded to the players and the way that they go about their business and the way they treat people.
How many years have you been with OKC? I think your LinkedIn said, what, 2012, 2013?
Yeah, this is season number 14. My first year was the year that we went to the finals. The Thunder was there in the finals against the Miami Heat. And of course, you know, I was 23. My head was spinning. I didn't know which way was up. So this has been, you know, really special to have this kind of second run here and gearing up for game one.
Is this core, like the personality of this core, unlike any other OKC team or any other professional sports team you've been around?
It's so hard to compare. You know, Kev, you've been doing this for so long as well. I think you were 2012, 2013 in that range.
2013 as well. Like, yep, same as you.
Yeah, the eras of basketball, just they shift so rapidly. The way that teams are built, the star power. You know, I kind of think of it this way when I look at all of the different teams that I've gotten to cover. It's like, I have three kids and I love all three of my kids equally, you know? And so it's really cool to see the different eras. Those teams obviously rocked, and this team really rocks too in its own way.
I mean, it feels like a college atmosphere in some ways, like just the way the players hang around post game and how young, obviously, the team is. They're literally younger than some college teams. And ultimately, man, that's the number one question people had about them on this run. Are they too inexperienced? Are they going to be able to make it? How are they going to deal with clutch moments? And we saw that ups and downs with the end of the Denver game two, whatever it was, with Chet missing the free throws, some mistakes by Dagnall. There were mistakes along the way, but I feel like this team has grown up from the outside. I feel like this team has grown up through a lot of this adversity throughout the postseason. Have you seen their personality shifted all throughout this postseason run and mature and kind of answer that question a lot of outsiders have had?
I don't know if their personality has shifted, but I think that they have actually leaned into and doubled down on what's gotten them to this point. They've really taken a very steady approach to consistent improvement. I think what we've seen that's maybe unique is this team, Kevin, is better now than it was at the start of a playoff run. And a lot of times you'll see teams that are viewed or even view themselves as a finished product by the time they get to the playoffs, that they've used the regular season and kind of they are what they are. And what's been really fascinating about this Thunder team is they've not viewed themselves that way. They viewed themselves as capable of improvement through the playoffs. I think part of that is because the average age is 24 and a half years old. You know, they are one of the youngest teams, I think they're the youngest team in the NBA for the second year running. And so they've had opportunities to continue to grow, and even more solidified role players, you know, guys like Alex Caruso and Isaiah Hartenstein, their improvement has been able to come within the Thunder's system and playing alongside some of these guys who are still developing and evolving as well. So, you know, Caruso, he's almost like dug in deeper into what he's capable of inside of the system, as opposed to maybe expanding what he does. And I think that type of collective improvement is something that this Thunder team always views as possible.
I think that's a good way to put it. And I feel like you mentioned how, you know, during the season, they've kind of evolved as well. We saw that comes from Dagnall, too, I'm sure. He used the regular season to experiment so much. He had a quote, I think it was like early March or something like that. He was talking about the two big lineup with Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren. And he's like, you know, we're trying things out. Like, it's not always going to make sense. And I think him coaching the way he does, experimenting, putting different lineups out there, different guys getting minutes throughout the entire regular season, is what leads to Jalen Williams being able to get plopped out there and get minutes all of a sudden in a series. It what leads to a deep rotation where different guys playing, Kenrich Williams getting opportunities, this collective buy-in they have with each other, but also the understanding that everybody has a role on this team depending on what the game demands. I think it's like reflective of what makes OKC so great with how they can shapeshift and play different styles, but also how the players as well are totally bought into that in the name of getting better, in the name of experimenting, in the name of progressing as a young team. It's unlike anything. I haven't seen a team like this before. Even that 2012 OKC team you mentioned with KD, Harden, Russ, that team wasn't anything like this in terms of like this approach with the way they are today.
Well, it's a culture of adaptability that's really been intentionally driven into the team since Mark Daigneault took over, really. You know, the last 5 years or so, they've focused on being able to get guys into lineups, pop them in, and have them ready for their moment. And that's why we see, you know, Jay Will, as you mentioned, be able to slide into that Denver series. He hadn't played much in the Memphis series. Suddenly, he's in there playing big minutes against Nikola Jokic. And all of a sudden, in Game 7, as you mentioned, shape-shifting, it's Alex Caruso defending Nikola Jokic. And so there's opportunities for this team to have lineup versatility and lineup flexibility. And it's not uncommon for guys to, you know, not play the entire first three quarters of a game and then suddenly get popped in there and play in the fourth quarter. We've seen over the course of the last couple of years, Isaiah Joe and Aaron Wiggins, they popped off for double-digit fourth quarters after having not played at all in the first three quarters of the game. And that readiness culture, it can sometimes feel like an NBA cliche, but it's really kept everybody on the roster live, and it's allowed guys to stay juiced up, stay ready. You know, you mentioned Kenrich Williams. He hadn't played at all in the first two series in meaningful minutes, and then suddenly game one against Minnesota in the Western Conference Finals, he's in there, he's junking up the game, he's going 3-for-3. You know, that's not possible if it's not a multi-year investment in that project.
It's pretty amazing to watch. And ultimately, I think it's going to help them against Indiana, because Indiana is another team that goes deep in their rotation and they play fast. Like, they wear you out, man. They look like the beautiful game Spurs sometimes with all the pitches and handoffs and cuts and relocations. Like, they just play so fast. And like, not just fast in, like, you know, kick aheads and transition, but fast in the half court. And that can get you tired, man. I really think that's one of the reasons why Indiana's been able to have some of their comebacks this year, is because they play the same way in these final 2-3 minutes of games. They don't just go ISO, pound the ball and slow down. They still play their style. But for OKC, they're comfortable going deep into their rotation. Yeah. They can go beyond 10 guys if they need to. Unlike a lot of other teams where it's like, oh, we have 7 guys we feel comfortable with, and like, we're really stretched thin if we go to our 8th or 9th guy. OKC is the opposite. They can go deep if necessary. Right.
There's a relentlessness to both of these teams, and it's going to be really fascinating to see how it plays out. Obviously, Rick Carlisle, just one of the best coaches of all time. You know, this guy is really adaptable, and we, you know, used that word earlier. And so it's going to be really cool to see these two teams go up against each other. And the other fascinating part is, yes, of course, like, they met a couple times in the regular season. But as I was saying about the Thunder, you know, both of these teams have evolved quite a bit over the course of the season, and even over the course of the postseason. And when you have young players like the Pacers do and like the Thunder do, it's possible for your team to shift the way that it plays. And so a lot of what the Thunder has been focused on at this point, you know, they've had this really nice stretch here of days to rest, recuperate, get physically healthy, but then also to really focus on itself and the fundamentals that were going to be critical regardless of whether it was the Pacers or whether it was the Knicks. And that's something that the Thunder has really leaned on over the course of time, even here in the playoffs when they've had layoffs before the Memphis series and, you know, before the Denver series, is, you know, focusing on the, on themselves first. Because once you get in the series, once you get into game one, that's when the series really starts to tell you strategically, you know, what you need to do. And, you know, so much for the Thunder. I mean, I think we saw in game one against Minnesota, they just went out there and they played their game. They played to their fundamental structures. And that's what helped them really propel and get a lot of burst in that game one against Minnesota and get that series started off on the right foot. So it should be really fascinating to see how these two teams come into this series and then, you know, continue to try to get better through the series.
I mean, Indiana has never seen a defense like OKC, and OKC has never seen an offense like Indiana's throughout this postseason run. But with that said, like, again, like, I keep, one of the reasons why, like, I keep thinking about with OKC, are we, like, we've seen this will be seven straight years with a different NBA champion. The one reason why I can't help but wonder if this could be the birth of actually a dynasty or a sustained contender in OKC is A, the youth, but B, like, just the adaptability of this youth to play different styles. They use like four or five different tactics against Jokic in the Denver series. They, you know, in the series against Minnesota, they're defending Ant differently. And then in the final game to close them out, that's when they eventually went to their aggressive swarming style against Anthony Edwards, similar to Jokic, you know, in the final game, putting Caruso on him, swarming him. But like, they're going to have something that Halliburton and the Pacers have never seen before. And it might not come in game one. It might not come till game three. It might not come until the closeout. But they just have so many different ways to play, and they have different lineups they can put out there. Where, like, Hartenstein, you know, Chet didn't play the two games against Indiana during the regular season. He was out for those games. Hartenstein right. was the guy against them, and they were switching screens with Hartenstein. Maybe they won't even have to play Hartenstein more than 15 minutes in Indiana, or maybe they'll go with two bigs. I don't know what they're going to do exactly, but that's because they have so many different options with what they can do. It's just, it's so unusual.
And it's really the power of continuity. And we see this team has been able to grow together over the course of time. You know, some of the key figures, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Lou Dort, Kenrich Williams is a vocal and lead by example kind of guy. Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren have been here. And then the guys that have been brought in externally, Alex Caruso and Isaiah Hartenstein. I mean, it just feels like, as Mark Daniel would say, that feels like those guys have been here for 3 years already, because they're players that are purely additive. You know, their entrance into the team has not taken away any opportunities for growth from the three, you know, core primary playmakers, scorers, ball handlers in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren. And because of that continuity that's existed, they've been able to experiment over the course of time with different ways of playing. And that includes the offensive end of the floor too. You know, it's not just Shai Gilgeous-Alexander that's now accustomed to seeing various different types of defenses, whether it be, you know, a team that really packs in the paint the way that Denver did in the second round, or a team that extends their pressure more like Minnesota did in the Western Conference Finals, teams that aggressively try to trap and double team and get the ball out of his hands quickly. Like, it's not just Shai that's seen that, but it's multiple players, you know, basically the entire team that's now seen that over the course of multiple seasons here. And so they can be adaptable and ready for the different things that are thrown their way on the offensive end of the floor.
It's going to be interesting to see what Indiana does. Earlier in this podcast, I threw out some stats about Indiana's zone tendencies in the playoffs. They've only had three possessions playing zone defense this entire postseason. OKC obviously forced Denver to play zone for basically a third of their possessions. Minnesota played a zone about five more times as often as they did during the regular season against OKC. So I wonder if we're going to see Indiana be forced to change who they prefer to be on the defensive end of the floor because of the issues that OKC can present. Ultimately, Nick, I don't know if you want to make a season series prediction, but I got OKC in five in the finals, man. I don't think that is disrespectful to Indiana. I think Indiana is a tremendous team. But I just think OKC is a better version of that with an all-time great defense. And that's where I think this is going to be the series that they stamp, approve it, that this is an all-time great defense. They were the best in the league by far all year long, not even close. Like, if you look at differential compared to league average, it is statistically the best regular season ever, regular season defense ever. The way they switch game plans against Jokic, one of the greatest players ever, the way they contain Ant in that Minnesota, after Julius Randle had a great playoff run, just turning him back into Knicks Randle in the postseason. I think they're going to present real issues for the Pacers, because not because of Indiana's limitations, just because of the greatness of the Thunder. That's what I'm anticipating. And I think they're going to sustain it, man. Like, all those picks Presti's sitting on, man. They still got a mid-first round pick this year in a good quality draft. Like, man, like, I don't think they're going away. I think this is just the beginning of you getting, you know, jerseys and shirts thrown on you and a lot of fun and Gatorade showers. I think it's just the beginning of that potentially. We'll see. We'll see. I mean, maybe Indiana will.
Great time. It's a great time in OKC, and you can feel the joy in the city. You can feel the excitement in the city. And you also, I think, can feel from the team the seriousness with which they take this and the way that they're excited to represent this city on the biggest stage. You know, they're extreme competitors, but they're also incredible human beings. And I think that that's really going to shine through here with the way that they compete together. For one another, the way that they, you know, have that next play mentality, the way that they, you know, just focus on controlling what they can control, which is their own play. And you know, I'm really excited for these guys because they've worked so hard and they're such high character people from high character families. They're going to get this great opportunity here right in front of them to try to win four before the Pacers win four. And that's, you know, my only feel is just like, both of these organizations and their fans can be extremely proud of what they've done this season and, you know, not just what they've done, but how they've done it.
Last thing here. I feel like everything you said about OKC, you know, the character aspect, but also everything we're talking about with the playing style. I have felt people in my personal life go from OKC haters to OKC admirers. Where, like, there are people who would say, oh, yeah, SGA flopping this Gen Z, you know, young kid team, think they're cool and commercials and all that. I've seen people go from haters of OKC to being like, wow, this team is actually really fun to watch. They're actually pretty amazing the way they play. And so it's been funny to see them, like, maybe they could become an America's team type of thing. Maybe they could become, like, this team that a lot of people enjoy nationally. That's on the table for both of these franchises as well. Because as you said, everything that's true about OKC, also true about Indiana. Two incredibly likable style of plays with likable stars or hateable stars if you're on the other side with Hal Leverton and an SGA. But like, that's part of it, man. Like, I'm fired up, man. I'm fired up, Nick, for this finals, dude. I am so excited for Thursday.
It's going to be so fun. And, you know, these teams, they're so competitive and they're so focused. You can just tell that they, you know, do not deter from what their brand is and what their identity is. And if they do for a few possessions, as Mark Dingle would say, like, they get the car back on the road pretty quickly. And, you know, I think to your point about OKC, you know, this is a group of guys that are really easy to root for. And of course, like, they understand there's going to be lots of noise in the NBA, you know, chatosphere. You know, there's gonna be a lot of stuff that comes their way, and that comes with the territory of, you know, being a great team and being a team that's in this position. I've really admired the way at an average age of 24 and a half years old that they've taken all of that in stride, that they've focused on themselves and they focused on being the best teammates to each other that they can possibly be. I don't know if you got the chance to hear Mark Daigneault, you know, post game, what he was saying as he was getting draped by towels and hats and stuff put on him. But, you know, he said that these guys represent everything that's great about being a team. And I couldn't echo that statement more fully, that is exactly what these guys exemplify. And it's a great representation, both of these teams, for the NBA as they step onto the biggest stage here.
Do your kids wear this shirt around the house at all?
They do. My oldest is 4.5. So we've been really trying to work on getting, you know, the small sizes. There's a lot of XLs floating around, but no, they do. It's been so special too. And I mean, I think this is also something that's so unique to Oklahoma City. You know, I've worked in New York City and in Nashville and, you know, some other places over the course of my career. And, you know, being in OKC is just such a unique landscape for a city and a team's connection. And, you know, Sam Presti and Mark Daigneault, they say, like, this city and what it provides in terms of an environment, in terms of an atmosphere, is really conducive to success. And this team really benefits from the support that they get here in the community that, you know, these guys, you know, feel that on a day-to-day basis without it being like intrusive and overwhelming to their daily lives. But they feel that they can focus on basketball and they can focus on getting better and improving incrementally day by day. And that's what has spurred on all of this growth over the course of the last few seasons. I mean, to be able to jump double-digit wins in 3 straight years is almost unheard of. And that's only possible if there is environment that's conducive to winning.
Crazy. And conducive to fun as well. If you want Nick Gallo's face on your shirt, Lily Loves Thunder on X and Lily Llama Creations on Etsy is where I got the shirt. Nice job by Lily putting this together. And cool, what's such a cool
amazing
moment with all the players wearing that shirt. That was awesome. Nick,
it was such a fun surprise, man.
Nick, you had the biggest smile on your face when that happened. Nick, I appreciate it, man. Thank you for joining me on the show, and best of luck, and enjoy every moment of these next few weeks in the finals. Enjoy it all, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Hey, Kevin, are we going to see you out in OKC?
I am doing pods after every finals game. Okay. So I'm not traveling for this year's finals, unfortunately. But maybe if I can make it out for an off day. So they know that there are some breaks in the finals.
I'm sure you've got private jets flying you in and out of wherever you want to go, you know?
Yeah, I wish. I'll be sitting in the middle seat on the way. But no, I would love to go out.
Enjoy these finals, man.
But no, I won't be able to be at a game because I'm doing the pods after, which, you know, for if you're listening to the podcast, live pods after every finals game. We'll be going live after every finals game to discuss it all. But I will not be in the arena for games. So I'll probably see you at Vegas for sure. Right? You want a summer league? I'm sure.
I'll be there.
If not an off day at the NBA finals. Appreciate you joining me, Nick. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Ken.
Big thank you again to CP, the franchise, and Nick Gallo for joining me. We'll be back again on Wednesday morning or Tuesday overnight, depending on the time zone you're in. You'll hear my next podcast. I'm going to have Mo Dakeel on, breaking down this series, the X's and O's. We'll go deeper into everything and give some real firm, serious predictions for what we expect in the NBA Finals. Then we'll be back again later in the week as well, covering the game post-game Thursday with Tom Haberstroh, plus going to have some draft conversation throughout the week as well. So stay tuned for that. We'll be back. Thanks to Mike, Emmy, and the whole team for producing today's episode. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again. Enjoy your week.